Good morning, and thank you all for coming on the very first day of the session early in the morning to a venue that's outside the main venue. We know how hard it is to get here, and we really appreciate your coming and being with us today. I do not have any financial relationships with the current commercial interest. But what I do have is an intense enthusiasm and appreciation for all the work that's being done by everybody in this room, and especially the panel, because what my role right now is to weave together what they've done as a base, the clinical care experts, people who are on the front line in reaching the people and the populations who so desperately need help from an environmental perspective, from an economic perspective, from a health perspective. And I want to build on that base and introduce those of you who are on the front line to some very exciting opportunities now, an incredible window of opportunity we have to really pull together a lot of capacity to reach that goal of community health and sustainability for all people. And like we've done so far, again, just to kind of, you know, refresh your memory quickly, is that we have tried to build the foundation that the people who are bearing the burden of disease, the disease disparate population, are also those that are environmentally burdened. And when we talk about environmental burdens, yes, we talk about exposure to pollutants. As Dr. Duane has mentioned, we have a lot of communities living near highways. As Lori Berry mentioned, we have communities that may be exposed to contaminated sites. Well, they also, an environmental burden could be considered lack of access to care, lack of access to infrastructure, whether it's transportation modes, whether it's safe drinking water. So we need to be thinking about the population that we normally serve in our respective jobs in terms of, is it environmental, is it health disparate, and they're usually about the same, minority, low-income, and other vulnerable populations. And what we've done in terms of making some progress, as Lori Berry mentioned, the focus is community health centers that are comprehensive and that are holistic and that are becoming the centerpiece for community and sustainability. And that's the next level. But we can go even farther to start building on some of these practices and these policies that are underway with agencies like Dr. Duane has mentioned outside HHS that are hugely important to the achievement of our goal. So that's kind of what I want to lay out today. And the first slide is to do that, I'm going to cover four areas, some of briefly, again, starting with the notion of the community health center, the health homes, with the essential services. Again, recognizing the crucial opportunities we have to align health with environmental justice through the commitment of the Environmental Protection Agency. Also recognizing beyond the work of EPA, we have important work being done on sustainability through agencies such as housing, urban development, transportation, agriculture. And then finally, looking at an exciting new train track that's out there in terms of federal action on environmental justice. So this is going to quickly highlight these points. And I will say that I have more slides than I have time, but I did that so that when you go home and you're on your plane ride or your train ride, you can take a look at these. Okay, the first point, and again, I think it's essential, again, as Lori Berry mentioned, it is about a community-based, community-centered health home. And what's exciting about this notion is it's not just about the delivery of medical care or health care. As Dr. Wilson mentioned, it's about the governance piece. It's about the ability of the people who are benefiting from an activity being able to be part of the design of how that is taking place. And something happened back in 2010. ATSTR, the Center for Disease Control, one of their centers is the Agency for Toxic Substance Disease Registry, engaged in a national conversation on public health and chemical exposures. And they spoke to over 1,000 communities. And these communities spoke loud and clear. They didn't really speak in terms of the nomenclature of what is the difference between a health center versus a community health center versus primary care. They said, look, we want you to start with us. We want you to start with where we are. We have multiple exposures. We don't have access to infrastructure and amenities. And we want comprehensive services. And we want them to be placed in an environment that will be promoting health benefits, such as physical activity, such as access to nutrition. And they also recognize that, again, many of the people bearing the burden of disease are also those with pollution. And so one of the recommendations coming out of this national conversation was right where we are all here today, this patient-centered, community-based health center in the community that's available and accessible is the centerpiece. And this is a very important statement coming out of one of our health agencies, and I think we need to ground that. And it's very powerful because up until this point, the communities may be asking for this, but they didn't have a context for it. The second opportunity that I want to jump over to, and one which I am so excited about, and I'm going to actually have people in this room stand up, and I think everybody should clap them, they're doing such good work, is that our administrator with the Environmental Protection Agency has fundamentally focused on the human, not just the environment. I think historically there's this perception that EPA has been concerned about the land, air, and the water, but what about the person? And from the day she began, it's linking these two. And it's recognizing that where they live, work, play, and learn is very important. And environmental protection is about public health protection. And what's interesting is if you look at this, the words out of Administrator Jackson's mouth, it matches what Dr. Wilson was saying about the definition of social determinants. So there's all this commonality. But this is the exciting news. I want to emphasize that our agency is not just talking, they're walking. And we have a number of offices whose work is really tying into not just policy, but practices on the ground, really looking at what's happening in the community. So to start with, I'd like to have Heather Case, who is the director of EPA's Office of Environmental Justice, stand. Okay. And I'd like to have Ann Carroll, who is with the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, stand. Yay. And I'd like to have Melissa Dreyfus, who's with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, stand. These people are the new star players in the team of increasing access to health and health care. And just to give you an illustration of how all of these are coming together, EPA's Office of Environmental Justice has created Environmental Justice Showcase communities, one in every single region of the country, and EPA has 10. Our project in Jacksonville, Florida, is the EJ Showcase for our Region 4, and the communities there back in the 90s were saying, we know that we're sick and dying, and what we need is a health home, something in our community that we can get to. And we want to be able to have access not just to doctors and optometrists and dentists and so on and so forth. We want to be able to have parks. We want to have access to food and food security. So our office has really taken that to bear, and they've been integrating the concept of brownfields. Ann Carroll's been working on this since the last millennium with me. We've gotten the city to volunteer property at low to no cost, maybe $1 a year, for some community health centers. So that's all great news. The environmental side of the equation is there. Up to one-third of the cost for health centers can be coming from the property itself. Well, what we then realized is that there's a donut going on. There's a lot of other health centers, which may not be community-based, which are tapping into the community health care dollars. So there's a problem there. So that's where the Superfund program is coming in now with a very specific project to put people on the ground to start talking and find out where those gaps are. So like I said, there's a lot of work that you wouldn't think that EPA is doing, which is really designed to get to the root causes and the challenges and the barriers. So that part is really exciting. It's also important, again, for those of you that want to dip your toe into another pond, the pond of EPA, is that our agency has developed a plan which is designed to deliver environmental justice to communities, again, with the goals being protecting the health and communities that are overburdened by pollution, recognizing that it's the empowerment of the communities to take action, which is consistent with the model of community health centers. And equally important is to establish partnerships, not just within EPA offices, not just within the federal family, but with state and local government, and also with foundations, with community-based organizations, with healthcare sectors. So it's really designed and to give a platform for everyone to come together. And the first three are related to some of our regulatory activities, such as rulemaking, permitting, and enforcement. And one may say, well, what does that have to do with today's conversation? Well, the rulemaking sets the standards for how much exposure is allowable. And that goes back to points that Dr. Duenas was mentioning. And this is a robust involvement for us to get involved in every segment of the issue. The last two, I think, are most directly related to this topic, which are the bookends of trying to pull together the non-regulatory capacity of EPA to build with community-based action, such as federally qualified health centers like our Jacksonville project, but also starting to say that one agency can't do it all. HHS can't do it all, and EPA can't do it all. So let's bring in our other federal partners. So it's a really good platform. It's on the web, and it's something that you may find interesting reading. And more importantly, an interesting opportunity for your action and involvement. As I mentioned before with Ann Carroll, who I think was probably the project officer for the first public health and brownfield efforts, is realizing, and Lori Berry mentioned this, there's a huge amount of financial capacity available through the brownfields program, which is now also including not just brownfields, which are sites which have a moderate to minimal contamination that can be revitalized, remediated and revitalized. There's also petroleum brownfields, basically gas stations, which are ubiquitous. But there's funding and capacity for assessing the site, for cleaning up the site, now for doing some planning not just on that particular site, but in a corridor area, and also public health monitoring. So there's important dollars and resources from the brownfields and the Superfund and the petroleum underground storage tank programs, which can be leveraged like Lori mentioned. Again, the benefits of integrating contaminated site redevelopment to address public health is to realize, like we said, property at no to low cost. We have a number of examples where local governments provided property for a dollar for a health center. Also, as we mentioned before, the concept of community health is really about governance engagement of multi-stakeholders, and this is another group of people who have already organized and coordinated to deal with an environmental contamination, a blight on a property, but which can be brought into the equation of the healthcare partners as well. And like I said, we have a number of success stories with a number of different types of models. We have health centers, community health centers. Some of them are federally qualified, some of them are not. Some of them are simply free health centers. A number of them in Florida. A lot of this work did begin in Florida, but we're seeing it leveraged outside the state. There's also a number of different types of activities besides health centers, and again, Ann has been a champion of this, is the concept of community gardens up into farmers markets and things like that. And also what's really exciting is I think this is probably the first time that a brownfields program has actually been successful in getting a HRSA grant. And this occurred in the central part of Florida, again, low-income minority. It happens to be a rural area, significant contamination, and now they're being able to bridge that gap between environmental and health. So like I said, for those of you who are in the business of trying to set up health centers, this capacity within EPA is very important. Also, as I mentioned before, I'm moving into the third area, building on the notion that it's not just access to health care, it's access to health. And I have mentioned an important alliance that was established by the White House and Congress, which is the HUD-DOT EPA Partnership for Sustainable Communities. And it was established in 2009 for the purpose of aligning funding and programs and policies between the three agencies so that they align themselves in terms of housing options, transportation choices, and environmental protection so that we do have truly healthy and sustainable communities. And this effort has done a lot in seeing how we can be leveraging dollars. And as we heard from our prior speakers, there's front and center opportunities to link with community health centers. Transportation is the key issue. How people get to a health center is crucial. It's not going to happen immediately where we have light rail, but maybe we can need walking sidewalks or bicycle trails or things like that. There's a lot that can be done, and a lot of money is now going into planning for this. And that's where people who are doing either policy or practice work on community health centers can be tapping into some of that regional planning effort. Again, on housing, Section 330 of the Public Health Service Act, which started the community health centers, mentions as a specific population those in public housing. UNCLE, this is a perfect relationship. And again, the funding, significant funding in the millions and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, is about the sustainability, the prevention piece, and working backwards so that, again, we can create healthy and sustainable communities and people. Also, and since she's here with CDC, it's really exciting that some of the health agencies, again, are looking into prevention and really focusing on prevention. And a major effort under the Affordable Care Act is dealing with community transformation grants. And again, this is up to $2 billion in 2014. And what's important is that they're recognizing that in order to eradicate chronic diseases, you can't just provide treatment for the diseases. You have to work backwards and provide those prevention opportunities. And community gardens is a major way, addressing health disparities and also dealing with the prevention mechanism. So again, this is an important example of alignment between different agencies, HUD, EPA, DOT, but also important capacity that we can be tapping into. And I think the final illustration, the final opportunity, I think, which is has huge momentum, is the federal action on environmental justice to protect human health through the Federal Interagency Working Group on Environmental Justice. A quick little history on environmental justice is that an executive order was established in 1994, recognizing, again, that minority, low-income, tribal populations, and other vulnerable populations may bear a disproportionate impact of environmental and public health problems. And the goal was to make sure that the agency's programs and policies and practices didn't contribute to that. What's exciting, again, under this administration is they've taken the concept beyond just doing away with the bad, such as exposure to refineries and power plants and so on and so forth, into the benefits and the amenities. And that's where community health centers squarely fit. This interagency working group was reinvigorated at the secretary's level of every agency. A memorandum of understanding was signed this past summer. And in this memorandum of understanding, you had 17 agencies commit to doing an environmental justice strategy. And these strategies, most of them have been posted on the web at the end of September. The goal is to have them finalized by February. If you read HHS's strategy, it is incredibly exciting. Fundamentally, they recognize the role of community health centers to deal with the population that's bearing the burden of disease and environmental exposures. And it sets out a whole roadmap on how HHS wants to integrate its activities. And if there's one walk-away step for you to do, it would be to pull up HHS's and EPA's plan and look at these and see how these can be leveraged to achieve the goals that you have for your own work as you leave this conference. I have two slides which are designed to give you a little bit more information on what is environmental justice, again, for those of you that haven't confronted it on a day-to-day basis. And our office, again, under Heather's leadership, has produced a series of papers, in fact, which will be released through an APHA special supplement, and there will be an event tomorrow night at 6 o'clock to release these papers, but it really puts some detail into what does it mean to be an environmental justice concern. Again, we know about the notion of proximity and exposure to pollution sources. We also know that when you're low-income and minority, you're not just dealing with one problem. You're dealing with multiple exposures, multiple stressors over time that can have an impact on your health and well-being. We've talked about the concept of physical infrastructure, which fundamentally is about the lack of access to health care, transportation, housing. We recognize that you have susceptible populations. We know that children are especially vulnerable, but children who come from a background of not having adequate food, who are exposed to pollution, need an even greater exposure of attention. And then you have unique exposure pathways, again, realizing that many low-income people rely on fishing in rivers and streams that are highly polluted for dietary staple. They may be drinking from water systems that are either not regulated or don't have treatment and monitoring from private wells. And then finally, and fundamentally, like we said, it's this ability to participate in decision-making so that they can influence the outcome of what happens in their community. It's not about what other people think they need. It's about working with this community to get what they all think can be most appropriate. And what's interesting, and I think this goes back to some of what Lori's done in hers, is the psychosocial stresses, the mental health component of an environmental justice community, which is fundamentally important. So like I said, this is just some background information for you. And then this slide is actually trying to, I guess, spark our thinking that those of us who come from a public health background often think of prevention and think of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. You know, tertiary being where you have the problems established and you're trying to improve those conditions of the individual. Secondary is where you can detect it early to try to take action to minimize the complications of the disease and its progression. And then primary prevention, trying to prevent the onset at the beginning. And I think it's real interesting to see how we can take these concepts and apply it and integrate it with the concepts of environmental justice and also sustainability. And again, the concept working backwards is the pollution prevention aspect. Let's change our practices. Let's do toxic use reduction. A big effort right now is the concept of green zones, where you're integrating environment, economy, and health to help communities and uplift them. And like I said before, in the Plan EJ 2014, you have other mechanisms such as permitting of facilities in the community, dealing with transportation and housing options. And finally, at the back end, we have enforcement and response to contaminated sites. But if we can walk away seeing how we from the health, we from the environment can put all these together, I think we'll start getting to the healthy and sustainable communities we'd like to see. And then finally, the walk away notion, we've always heard of the concept of making lemonade out of lemons. And we know our lemons, in this case, are the disease disparities and the environmental degradation. And we are making progress when we can come up with community, again, not just health centers, but community health centers that are building upon what's being done now in terms of a medical home and responding to pollution and taking it to the notion of using the lemonade to prevent the scurvy. Looking at the health home concept, essential services being provided, enabling services being provided, and also trying to think how we can work holistically to help build these the health and safety of the communities. And I think my parting point, this is the epidemiologist me coming out, I don't know how many of you are familiar with James Lynn, but he was actually a physician on a ship in the British Army. And he noticed that healthy men who came on board within a number of weeks or months were starting to suffer from adverse health problems, you know, teeth rotting, foul, you know, their skin was just getting sick and ill. And so he said, well, I'm out here at sea. I don't have anything else to do with my time. I'm just going to do a case-control study. So he gave some of the sailors seawater. He gave them some of them rum. He gave some of them a nectar of who knows what, and he gave some of them fruit, some fruit juice, and he noticed almost immediately that those who had gotten the fruit juice became instantly better, instantly healed. So he gave all the people on that ship the citrus, and they were cured of scurvy. So it was one of the first epidemiologic case control studies that was ever done. Well, that's the good news. The bad news, it took the British government 40 years to change its practices to address and implement what he had designed. Well, then the good news is within 2 years of the British naval government changing their behaviors and their practices, scurvy was eradicated. So my hope is that by bringing together environment and health, weaving in the economic factors, we can do the success story of James Lynn, but cut out the 40 years of the delay. So with that, I will end, and we will move on to our next part of the discussion.
Great. Thank you, Susie, very much. So I guess it's time to open up for questions. Again, what we've tried to do is to tie the whole thing together in terms of the continuous loop of social determinants, showing you an example of something on the ground, which is actually where my interests lie. I'm a clinician by heart, but I mean, I think it's important that we can talk about this stuff, but we have to have the folks on the ground doing it, and that's what Lori's Health Center is doing. To sort of Dr. Duenas linking the environment and certainly in particular vision problems, but just setting the stage for policy, and then Susie, as I said, is sort of wrapping things up. So I'll open the floor to questions. And if you can do one of two things. You can either come up here and ask the question, in which case I don't have to repeat it, or you can just say it and I have to repeat it for the taping purposes. Yes. Sure, come on up. It's a small group.
Yeah.
Sue, could we go around the room and have everybody just give us their name?
That's a great idea.
Just before your question, yeah.
I'll introduce myself when I ask.
Okay. All right. Well, come on up. You can come either right here. You can stand right here, and I've got the mic right here.
Did you want to start with your?
I'm Janice Winters. I'm at the Illinois College of Optometry. I'm an optometrist, and I'm I'm the Action Division Care representative on the Action Board.
I'm Melissa Dreyfus with the EPA's Office of Supervisors.
I'm Kathy Mason with Curbline's Mirror.
I'm Dahlia McMillan, Empire State College, formerly Lighthouse International.
Kevin Frick with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. I'm the economist.
Kevin Frick.
I'm Brahim, an ophthalmologist by training, and currently EIS officer for the CDC.
And Carol Suzer, officer from Woodland Rehabilitation, part-time doctoral student at Johns Hopkins.
Kelly Hip, American Optometric Association. She's also a section counselor for the Vision Care section. And a lot of other.
I'm Renee Micah. I'm a pediatric optometrist at the Community Health Center in Michigan and the chair of the Vision Care section.
Hi, I'm Heather Case. I'm with the Office of Environmental Justice at EPA.
And I'm Greg Wolf. I'm the Governing Counselor for the Vision Care section, and I'm an optometrist at the Tucson VA.
He's also the incoming chair of the section.
Great, thank you.
And my name is Bill Monaco, and I guess you could call me a gerontological optometrist because I live in a gerontology patient. I do nursing home care primarily in my practice, and I am the project manager for the graduate programs at Salish University in Philadelphia, which includes a new Master's of Public Health program. The question or the comment that I think I'd like to make is probably living this for over 15 years now, and trying to provide care and service to an underserved, unidentified population, and that's people that are admitted into skilled care facilities. And what Dr. Duane has said about the community health centers not having 82% of them do not have eye care. I think the numbers are comparable for skilled care facilities throughout the country. Probably 80% do not have eye care. I think that this is a tragic oversight. I can see it in community health centers because the patients are ambulatory. They are probably more accessible in terms of the provision of subspecial cares, if that's what you call this. But when a patient is admitted to a skilled care facility, they drop off the edge of the world for eye care. And those patients that are cared for throughout their lives for glaucoma, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy are essentially lost. And so what I've tried to do is, in a very small scale way, provide a conduit for that care and to promote it. But you know what I'm finding out today is that we don't, I'm doing it the wrong way. I think that what needs to be done, and I hope it doesn't take 40 years, is that we do need to mandate this care in facilities. We need to have a strong voice to mandate the care in the facilities so that these patients do not get dropped off from the care. Because all of the conditions that were described, all of the eye care conditions that are prescribed, are asymptomatic. The skilled care facility providers don't know it's there, unless somebody looks inside their eyes and tells them it's there. And I can give numerous examples of years of data collection. Now, I've tried to go the other way. I've tried to convince skilled care facilities that there is a problem. They don't care. The skilled care facility providers, the administrators, don't care. And it's not because necessarily, it may not be necessarily, I hope it's not, because they don't care as much as they're not required to care, and they've got other things to deal with. So I would suggest that if there is a way for us to partner, and I like Dr. Duane's suggestions for trying as many different organizations as possible to bring the visibility to the forefront for this, It's not about optometry or ophthalmology. It's just about the right thing to do. And the choice is the patient goes blind unnecessarily, or we manage and treat the patients and care for them and give them the quality of life that they deserve. That's public health. So I don't know if it's so much a question as a call to action, and I'm really encouraged by what has happened this morning and the work that all of you have outlined. I think that we have a long way to go, and yeah. It's like screaming into a hurricane. I can tell you, it's exhausting work.
I guess my question is a little bit different. As an environmental person, I recall from my ancient history learning about lead poisoning. It was actually an eye doctor in Brisbane that made the connection between lead exposure and toxicity. And I'm wondering, for the environmental people, are there other kinds of exposures to vision care people that we need to know that this kind of toxicant actually creates some deterioration in function or cell? So that we're aware that this might be an issue and we can engage directly. Obviously, we don't want to be at that tertiary, you know, prevention state, but I think there's some real opportunities for educating us on what it is you know and how we could, you know, partner and make the case for the need for these services around certain areas or with certain kinds of exposure scenarios. So I don't know if there's such a list of chemicals, but that might be really
useful. So I think your question is, are there other exposures?
Yes. Or combination of, you know, nutrition and exposure. And certainly we're talking a lot about environmental health. Talking about occupational health right now. But obviously, you know, vision issues with occupational health would be another kind of key area.
Absolutely. And there has been a tie to occupational health and vision and eye health in the past, and there still is. But some of that in the very beginning, and I guess it's more of you know, our own thinking within optometry. A lot of that was related to lighting and, you know, the ergonomics of what you're doing and that kind of thing. The basis of this, what we're talking about, this transformational approach of looking at specific environmental toxins and then relate those to vision and eye health. That has been done, and there is a lot of literature on that. There's also, we didn't talk about it, but from a zoogenic standpoint, there's also things like Toxicara, Toxicati, other things that are embedded in the environment that can have significant effects, including blindness in children through oogenic type problems and parasitic problems. So there's all kinds of ties. And we need to do a better job of getting that information to you so then you can see the you know, the nexus to what we're doing and the importance of working together. So I appreciate that. And then Bill, on yours, I just want to mention that you bring up a good point, because in reality, you know, when we start talking about skilled care facilities, and what you were saying is so true. And I used to go into nursing homes, so I saw it myself. And so it's obviously it's going to take policy change, no doubt. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And part of that is from a grassroots point of view, we haven't done well of letting the people in the communities know of this problem and know that, you know, they are a key to unlocking the potentials that exist to change it. And then when you were talking about a skilled facility, a nursing facility, I was thinking of another skilled facility that is completely lacking vision and eye health, and that's schools. So here we have schools with an eye chart on the wall that's doing a disservice, and we don't have care there. What is going to get care there is policy changes. We're trying to get those policy changes made in school-based health centers, and we see some of them. Renee can tell you about some that are actually working, but they're few and far between. So getting care to the populations that need the care on the ground, that's the thing that needs to be done. You know, so those are the kind, and Susie might have something to say about the environmental, too. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, I actually have something to say about the money.
Where's the money?
Right?
So as I see it, it's not the mandate, it's the money. So where does the money come from? And you hear everywhere you're reading that in this country we're spending as much or more money than we should be spending on health care. So if we believe that more money should be spent on eye care, prevention, primary care in communities, then it has to come from somewhere, right? So that's what's sort of challenging about what we're facing right now, because we're all being asked to participate in something called accountable care organizations that are dominated by who? Hospitals. And hospitals is where probably the money has to come from. And it's not that people don't care. Why did the Lynn Community Health Center only belatedly in 2009 start an eye care clinic, even though we had a dental clinic in 2001? We were worried about the reimbursement. I mean, this is really sort of the issue for all of us, and I'm sure the issue for the skilled nursing facilities as well.
Sue, I'm going to add that because Laura, I think that brings up an excellent point. I did not realize that the money is going to be coming from hospitals, because the three health clinics that we got started in Florida, followed up by a number of federally qualified health centers, was supported by the hospitals because they were losing money because this population was going to the emergency room for primary care. And so it was that linkage and that aha moment on the hospital's part where they started not just freeing up their own dollars, but taking off that noose around the neck to keeping community health centers from coming into play. So I think that's a really exciting opportunity to link the brownfields with what you're talking about.
The hospitals need to be willing to shrink a little bit,
right?
Because maybe they'll lose a little less money taking care of our patient population. In my community, they are interested, but it is we're all kind of small players in this drama.
Right. I'd like to just quickly comment on how you get vision services going. And it's really the rubber meets the road around reimbursement. And so you actually see more professionals getting an MBA degree. Like there's a chief medical officer I know who also has an MBA. So people are getting much smarter about these things. And we have to be realistic. If there isn't reimbursement, the ability to bring on a service is going to be challenging. So the reason I commented that optometry needs to be in primary care, or vision services need to be in primary care, is because that opens the door for reimbursement, for enhanced payments, things of that nature. However, if you get creative people, chief financial officers, who are on board with this stuff, where there's a will, there's a way. That's why I said the intersection between policy and putting things into action as community health centers, time and again, you have examples of challenges that communities have faced, and they've been able to get past those challenges and to make something happen. So while we're working on policy reform and feeling like we have to wait 40 years, there are true examples of champions and leaders and smart thinkers who figure out a way to get it done. So I wouldn't want anyone to leave this room with any sense of despair. This is hope, and beyond optimism, we're headed in the right direction.
Thank you so much, folks.